Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Took a little field trip during the week. I think it was worth it. See what you think.
Benedict Cumberbatch, good morning.
Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
Good, thanks. I should explain to people, we're at the RDS. You were the keynote speaker at the AIB Sustainability Conference.
Crikey, was I?
Yeah.
I felt more like an interview than a keynote speech, but yeah, I was...
A keynote interview.
I kicked things off, yeah.
So look, people obviously know you from films, shows, The Avengers, Sherlock, Patrick Melrose, more recently The Roses, The Thing with Feathers. They might be less aware that you're a very committed activist, everything from the environment to Gaza. Where does the urge to activism come from?
Just being a citizen of the world. And I think within the realm of storytelling, you're often educating yourself, often on the run, about how and why the impact of these stories that are coming to you in script form, whether they are geopolitical in their nature or about environmental catastrophe or their satire dealing with both of those things, whatever form it reaches you, comes through the work, and it just comes through being a father in his late 40s and someone who pays his taxes and is in the world.
Tell me a bit about your interest in environmentalism.
Well, where to start? I mean, I guess I have three children, and I think, look, maybe before then, when fame really hit people with causes, then you immediately have an agency for them that they want to ally with. And whether it was Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, you know, you lean into listening. You hear what the cause is, what the problem is, what the issue is, and then you think, okay, fine, what do you want me to do? You want me to turn up to something? You want me to issue a statement? You want me to sign a petition? And it just slowly builds. And then with that advocacy comes a responsibility and also a kickback. And you have to answer to it. You have to be questioned on it and examined on it. And of course, the easy, soft target is to be accused of being a hypocrite. You know, why did you go there if you support human rights? Why did you use that form of transport if you support environmental causes? And I think what my advocacy has reached in recent years, and very recently with the Green Rider, which I'll get onto, is the idea that it is more to platform through the attention on me those who are in that field for real, who are working on the front line of refugee camps around the world, who are working on the front line of environmental catastrophe around the world, whatever the cause is, social or environmental, and give them the spotlight that's usually on you.
So it's like an introduction. Economy, you can
build that attention and direct it away from me to people who really know what they're talking about. Because otherwise, two things happen. One, you're accused of being a hypocrite. Two, you're also not an expert in that field and can be found out.
Yeah.
And so within that, though, to knuckle down on what I do speak about and understand, I found that often quiet efficacy of behind closed doors fundraising is phenomenally more successful, because you're not dealing with a press interaction, kickback. You can't be accused of humble bragging or moralizing or virtue signaling, all the kind of negative cultural war kind of critique of trying to do something that you think might result in a better outcome. You can raise millions behind closed doors with deep pockets by having a few like-minded artists in there to entertain people who want to direct their philanthropy towards the cause that's being mustered by whoever it might be, Kate Blanchett for the UNHCR. And I learned that from her, actually.
But the other thing... Why do you care about people accusing you of virtue signaling?
You grow a thicker skin.
Because they're the people who do nothing, like...
Yeah, you grow a thicker skin. But this leads me on to my next point as well, is that we have to shift the narrative here. None of us are perfect, and it's better that 99 imperfect people do something than one perfect person does. It's about meeting people where they're at and asking them to contribute something. The other level of hypocrisy that's often leveled is the other type of accusation of hypocrisy is to do with my industry, which is an incredibly wasteful industry.
Yeah.
For example, the live action film of Little Mermaid consumed as much carbon emitting energy as Dominica did in a month.
Wow.
And the main causes of it are fourfold. It's transportation, it's food, energy, and materials. So how do we clean up our own house? Well, usually in my position, the very rarefied air, first of all, of working, then the rarefied air of being in a position where I can get projects green lit, where they're dependent on my participation, and also in the rarefied air of being a producer where I have a certain management of the means of production, you can start making demands that shift the systemic operations of those wasteful parts of our industry. You can ask to travel in only electric vehicles and share your ride. You can ask not, you don't need to be flown in the privacy of a private jet. You can travel domestic and commercial and it still be very, very comfortable. You can insist on less meat and more variety of vegetables at the dining table and for catering. You can also try and push producers and companies like Netflix and Disney towards mobile and clean energy sourced battery powered generators as opposed to diesel, which not only is better for the health of the crew and the environment, but also doesn't interrupt sound so much, which your technician here would appreciate. It's beneficial all around. You can look at other systems of how you upcycle materials so that the waste product of a set build isn't just being put in a skipped, but is being rebought by another company, which saves on their budget. So again, it's all about incentivizing with money. At the end of the day, you may have an outlay for, I can't remember the sort of job title, but an environmental steward as such, who okay. whose specific job is to kind of audit your carbon footprint and where you are wasting, where you could be more resourceful and conserve energy and reduce pollution. And that person is a fee and interrupts the usual systemic practices of old school ways of doing things on a film set, which, as we all know, can be generational, need a lot of shifting through narrative and persuasion. But in the end, it affects the pocket as well. I mean, looking at a broader sphere of it, and having talked to AIB and their assembly of like-minded guests, it's about driving the idea that green is the new gold. It's a profitable enterprise to position yourself behind. It is a huge growth industry, if not the biggest growth industry. And ultimately, whatever we play and however we're forced by the kind of short-term, monthly, quarterly report of profit margins, they won't exist unless the resources that those profit margins come off are sustained. So it is a system that we're breaking down in the immediate for absolute loss in the short, slightly less short and long term.
Yeah.
So once you educate people or incentivize people with the idea that actually, no, you can make money in your quarter. Yeah, there's outlay, but you'll return. The return is massive on that. You then start to see the progress. So, for example, with a bank loaning to a more energy-efficient house, they know that the energy bills are going to be lower, and therefore the people they're loaning to are more likely to have more liquidity to pay off their mortgage. So it makes sense to invest in houses that are more energy-efficient.
Did having kids make you more environmentally conscious?
Yes, I've gone very off piece with my story. Of course.
Yeah.
The second one in particular, I'm an only child, and I don't know if other parents out there sort of felt the similar sensation if they've been in my position as an only child coming into creating a family of more than one. Everything shifts, and with the first, obviously, but with the doubling, how do you do that? How do the resources of your love, of what you have to give as a parent, the nurture, the care, the time, the effort, the money, but also just the love, does it have to divide or does it multiply? What about the world? What about the thing that sustains this beyond the house and the draining resources that another life, but that life could be the answer to those problems with resources? So all that thinking really just really, really accelerated when our second boy was born.
I saw you say as well that becoming a father, and I think we underestimate that probably the biggest shift that happens in most men who become fathers is fatherhood. It's the thing that changes the most, I think.
Yes.
You said that your emotions became paper thin. It changed how you acted. It reminded me of, you know, that opening line from Joan Didion in her book about her daughter, Quintana: after she was born, I was never not afraid.
Yeah.
It's a touch of that, isn't it?
That's brilliant. Yes, it is. But also the link of generations and the understanding of what your parents went through, it is an immediate sense of community with that and convening with that, which I think is hugely important for the environmental sphere as well. This idea of learning from elders, learning from wisdom and what that is, that carry, that tradition. I'm talking as someone who had the privilege of a very secure and loving upbringing. Not everyone has that security and love. And my gratitude just exploded exponentially, realizing what it was to hold this vulnerability, to be this barrier between this thing of your flesh and blood and something well beyond that, which is the miracle of children. They are The only unique selling points are they are something other that comes to us that's nothing to do with nurture or the parental gene pool. It's just something that they innately are. But you are the adult carrier. You're the membrane between it existing and not existing. The responsibility of that is so enormous.
Yeah.
And the well of love, the well of sacrifice of self, that suddenly you become so much larger than your own story in that moment. And part of that is linking to your parents, I feel.
You said earlier that we live in a regressive, patriarchal, misogynist time. Yep. And you're rearing boys in that. I'm rearing girls, which comes with its own issues in this mm-hmm. world. But I actually imagine that rearing boys is even more scary in that kind of world, is it?
I'm not very good at quantitative comparisons, not least because I don't have girls in my life. But I think there's a huge responsibility at the moment to battle against the consistent pushback that women's rights are having across the globe in every sphere, culturally, politically, economically. And it is, it's just so, so stark when you've got the kind of, can I say dick swinging? Mm-hmm. I mean, sorry, I maybe shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
It's so, it is almost that gross though. It is almost that gross, the disregard for the respect and the understanding that the need for equality and the idea that some of the worst male behavior can be justified because of the exemplars of some of the rulers we have in power at the moment is horrifying. And it permeates culture. It can do. It can permeate everything. And that's why it's so important, whether it's sport, art, anywhere where narratives and emotions and focus is attained beyond the political sphere, that we really can drive a better message of equality through those channels.
I want to come back to that. I saw something you said about the Oasis concerts in the summer. Mm. You thought that was actually an outpouring of a healthy kind of masculinity in a way.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so, because it was men not ashamed of showing their sentiment and their feeling for this amazingly emotional reunion of two brothers. I mean, one of the highlights of the evening in terms of response was when they put their arms around each other at the end of the concert. I mean, the uproarious cheer of reciprocal love for them getting it together and getting on with it, it was extraordinary. But men of all ages, actually, young and old, but a lot of people in my bandwidth of those who were teenagers when rock and roll came back screaming and alive and kicking in the form of those Gallagher brothers, and definitely maybe. I mean, it was such a seismic moment in my youth. And to see a lot of that age group just looking at each other going, oh my God, it was amazing.
Yeah.
You do get those moments in other cathedrals of community, whether it be football or culture. But it is quite rare in the male sphere to have that kind of outpouring of sentiment and emotion.
I was talking to Jeremy Irons recently, and he talked about going to an all-boys public school, as you call them in Britain, which what we'd understand as a private school.
Yes.
He felt it was essentially a factory for teaching men to repress their emotions in a really unhealthy way. What was your experience? You went to Harrow.
I mean, being really nice, a different generation, obviously. A long time ago. But very much. My dad's experience of that would have been very similar, was very similar. I don't know, because I think a lot of the sensitivity of my sensitivity was kind of, there were outlets for it. There was a great artistic output, whether it was on canvas or on a stage. I feel the arts and the humanities were celebrated as STEM, or the idea that you could express yourself was as valid as the idea of this masculine misnomer that you have to sort of be strong in order to support the other. I mean, there was a bit of that for sure. I think there was a slight schizophrenic split in my time there between the characterization of what they wanted out of you, both a leader and a team player. I kind of get that. It is a nuanced balance, but it.
Yeah, so it was
okay. We're unpacking so much now, aren't we, about colonialism, about sort of systemic inherited understandings of that through educational models and practices and beliefs and traditions. So, yeah, I'd have to sit with that question for a lot longer and really, really go back in my memory to be completely honest with you about it. But I feel, whether it was a sense of instinctual rebellion, I definitely, the artistic community at my school was definitely on the outside. It was more jock orientated, for sure, more military, more jock orientated. Boys being boys, that phrase. And so,
What does that mean, boys being boys? What's that mean to you when you say it now?
It means a lot of what becomes toxic in male culture. And, you know, I'm not saying that with a smirk or a smile or thankfully any sense of personal recognition, but just memory of some of the behaviours at school at my time, during my time.
The reason I've gone off on this tangent is because I feel that if we take your new movie, The Thing with Feathers, and people here know the Playboy end of Murphy with Cillian Murphy in it, I feel like Cillian Murphy, I think, is, I think Max Porter, who wrote the book, is, are you interested at the moment in creating narratives that are a counter narrative for men and boys and telling those kinds of stories? Yeah.
I am also interested in being within the other cultural sphere and leaning into listening to understanding why that masculinity is so important to preserve, whether it's a Guy Ritchie film or a Marvel Cinematic Universe, maybe less so, and actively pursuing a change in that as well. Because I think, you know, you have to meet people where they are in this conversation.
Okay.
I think you have to reach across as well and agree to disagree perhaps, but at least go, do you know what, you know, being misguidedly called touchy-feely or lefty, flim-flammery, whatever it might be, the dismissive nature of, oh, just get on with it, you know, be a man about it. It has to be challenged, but it can't be challenged from afar. You have to be in it in a way as well. So I don't just seek out work that has to do with that as an issue.
Yeah.
I think it's in my nature, and therefore there's an immediate pull for people creating that kind of work to go, well, he's comfortable with vulnerability as being a part of being a human being, and essentially in terms of this conversation, being masculine. It's all right to feel. I've never thought, oh, well, that's my mission, and I'm sort of seeking it out actively, which is why I mentioned the Guy Ritchie film, because that's a complete polar opposite, maybe in a way, to what Dad goes through in Grief is the Thing with Feathers.
Tell me a bit about the Thing with Feathers and what Dad, your character, goes through.
It's the story of a man coming undone in the first year after the very sudden death of his wife and trying to rear two boys in that overwhelming period of grief and how it manifests in this very idiosyncratic metaphor of humanoid crow creature, which comes alive because of his work in the book, because he's a Ted Hughes scholar writing a treatise about the crow poems or a paper, I can't remember what the form is, but in our version, he's an illustrator, graphic novelist who's creating a visual piece that then comes alive, but is alive to him and the children. It's not a psychotic split just for him. It is their experience as well. So it's about, metaphor aside, it's about male grief. It's about what happens when the matriarch is untimely ripped from that sphere and what three boys do and how they cope and don't cope and how they split apart very physically in the film and then come together by allowing grief to be a part of their life, by acknowledging it and not hiding it, not coping, not sending the children away, but letting them see their father go through it, and the love and understanding that then is reciprocated between the two generations in this unfathomable mess of unwanted, unruly, chaotic emotion that grief is.
What did you learn about grief making it?
I learned that it's universal. I learned that the smallest gestures can carry the most amount of emotional impact. It's not necessarily a man breaking down after holding it together in the funeral for his children. It's folding clothes away and emptying a rack and another part of the physical reality of that person disappearing that can be as triggering and as upsetting. I learned that grief is a many-shaded, unregulated, non-stage, as in it doesn't you don't graduate from one to eight of that ridiculous sort of self-help thinned down version of it. You can be as impacted by anger a month, a year after you first are than you are in the first instance. And the same with all of it. The level of energies, the empathy, the apathy, the fear, it's a jumbled mess, and it's not in your control. And the thing that lets hope in is an acceptance of that. An acceptance of the vulnerability that it puts you in, that it's okay to have these feelings.
Do you learn a lot about yourself with each project like that that you make as well, yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, what did you learn about yourself through that?
That loss is takes many different forms. I was working through something at the time, which was... I've experienced grief in my own life, but it was extraordinary how the emotions that I was feeling were more tied with another event of loss than with the actual loss of, in my case, my sister a few years ago. I learnt how much I'd been suppressing feelings that were incredibly accessible to me. And that's strange for an actor to say. So it was a lot of catharsis. And I learned, again, just going back to the main point, like, well, about myself, about how you're not alone in this, that this is a universal part of being a human. It's part of our human condition.
Yeah, my brother died quite young, when I was quite young as well. I was youngish. And I said to my wife after a few years, I said, so I didn't really grieve there. I was fine with that. I got on with it. And she said, ah, Jesus, no, hello. Did you see yourself?
Yeah.
Was it a bit like that with your sister, that you thought, okay, that happened, and get on with it? And afterwards you realized.
Absolutely. And I felt like, you know, there were moments, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about it. It's incredibly personal.
No,
and there are other people involved who aren't here to say whether they're comfortable with that or not. But when you feel you're holding some of it, it's strange. There were some moments where I was questioning, why am I not more upset? And then suddenly it would just be like an avalanche. Yeah.
Can I ask you about something that I'm fascinated by? After you finished up in school, so you were 18, 19, and you went on a gap year, but not like hanging around the beach in Thailand. You went to Tibet to teach English to monks, I think?
Yes. A couple of things to correct slightly there.
Okay,
geographically, I was not in Nepal. I was on the border near Darjeeling in India.
Right.
In West Bengal. And... teaching is a very loose term. Cultural exchange.
Okay.
I mean, I was billed as an English teacher, but I literally had to build a blackboard. No one had done that before in that assignment. And kind of structure classes based on ability, which meant I was teaching sometimes a 12-year-old and a 42-year-old in the same class. And then I was also teaching in the Tibetan community at large in the village and in the primary school there.
It's a remarkable thing for an 18 or 19-year-old to decide to go and do. Was
right.
it the,
and
the
I,
Buddhism?
And I didn't really take the I didn't take the teaching part into account. And it was a very unfair exchange, and I acknowledge that. It wasn't cultural tourism, however. I did give a lot, and it was an experience. And there was a lot of hardship as well as extraordinary elated highs and learnings. And
you got a practice
something
out of it?
Yeah, something that set my spiritual life on fire and began a journey which will probably be lifetimes rather than just this lifetime. But it was one of the most profound experiences of my life, probably the most at that point. And the lure of it, being at this incredibly privileged school where I could have chosen all sorts of different directions to go in, as far as what to do in volunteering or teaching or aid work or what have you, and where in the world that could be, or just take some time out and living for a bit and then go on a holiday. You know, all these choices. The first thing that I heard about was this person coming to talk about this post within the Tibetan communities in India, the refugee communities there. And it was such a strong pull as to be subconscious. I can't really explain it other than maybe a previous life or some kind of connection to it.
Yeah.
Because there was no reason. There was nothing in my schooling. There wasn't a moment where I went, I'm really interested in Buddhism. It grew out of that. I was aware of Buddhism, and I thought it held more interest to me than the organized religion that my schooling was based on, because it was more a philosophy. So it felt more about coming to it through reasoning and empathy rather than, no, this is what you're born to, this is what you'll be. It didn't feel so preordained. And yet, funnily enough, the pull towards it did in an odd way feel preordained. But nobody told me, it just came from within.
Yeah.
So it felt like a very authentic reason to start that journey there. And look, I gave them a little, they gave me an inordinate amount.
Your meditation practice seems to be very central to how you function in the world, is it?
As and when there's time for it, yes. Which is, it's rare ground. But, you know, I do try and do that. I use it a lot in my work. I use it a lot to level myself after very heightened moments like this, or red carpets, or... And it can be very instantaneous. I sometimes do it on a stage. You know, it doesn't have to be on a cushion with a view of a mountain. of which there was quite a lot of, as you can imagine, in West Bengal. But it's really about finding your centre anywhere you are at any time. Even in the middle of this interview, when I'm searching, I'm slightly hungover. I had a skinful last night because I'm in Dublin. I'm a little tired. I've already have been on this incredibly exposing but invigorating and extraordinary stage. So I'm finding it difficult to find my finding my no, that's not like a warm up. Now I'm completely drained. So every now and again, I've just been having to kind of recharge my focus here. And I think it's similar. It's a similar.
And do you find this? Challenging or an effort or intense as well? You know, a lot of actors can just start talking about themselves and kind of go into autopilot and just do it, keep doing it.
I think there's always a cost. Yeah. Whether people acknowledge that or not, or feel very at ease of it. Yeah. Most of us, I would say, that I speak to anyway, it's not normal to sit down in front of a microphone. And, you know, our job is abnormal enough as it is, but there is a craft, there is an artistry to that, which is honed and practiced and rehearsed and in our bones by the end. But this is, no one teaches you about this. No one gives you the kind of guidelines to fame and who you are as yourself, or as much of yourself as you reveal.
Is fame weird?
Of course it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Are you managing okay with it, do you think?
From time to time, very well. Other times, you know, I have great fun. And then at other times it's, you know, it's a lot of head traffic. It's too much. It's silly.
Do you get enough time on your own and quiet time and everything? Do you build that in?
For sure. And immersion with family and nature is my kind of key to doing that.
You have a 2-week rule with the family.
Either they come with or I shuttle to and from. Yeah. And we've been able to sustain that pretty remarkably over the last 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Benedict, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.